happened, but two I think are worthy of note. In the last few years, that changes the picture from perhaps 77 when we borrowed last time. One is that the federal government does not charge interest, and we have already brought that to your attention. Another is that they are finding ways to force states to remain or get back to solvency as much as possible, and they are in fact applying sanctions. If a state gets into a borrowing mode, the employers eventually pay a higher tax as a kind of a payback or a surtax. And the state cannot pass any laws which would require more payout of benefits. In other words, if you're in that kind of a situation and you owe the debt, and you would get to a point where you could not raise your benefit amount, you couldn't change your law to pay out more. So it gets extremely complicated when you're a debtor state as to what prerogatives you as state legislators have to even change the law. If you were considering some of the bills that we've had before you, upon which we've already testified, which maybe just changed a little bit and maybe pay out $10,000 more benefits for some reason, even that would be a sanction that would cause employer taxes to be raised.
Okay, we went a little bit beyond the bill, but Representative Johnson.
Back to the bill and the information you provided. Could you provide for the committee an example of a person going who became unemployed using your top chart of figures with the 8-week sign off the system and explain exactly what happens using Joe Jones as an example of somebody who became unemployed, so that the committee can understand the difference between the 12-week sign off with the weekly benefit reduction versus the 8-week sign-off in your examples. I think the committee needs that so that we know the difference.
Representative Johnson, Donna Hunter, Employment Division. Basically, under the example shown on your sheet of paper there, a person would, for instance, have quit their job due to a personality conflict with their foreman, have come in and filed for benefits. We would deny as a quit without good cause, using that example. At this time, a person then has to work and earn four times their weekly benefit amount to purge that denial, and they automatically lose eight times their weekly benefit amount from their total maximum benefit amount. Under the example here, instead of having to work and earn four times the weekly benefit amount, they would sign off 8 weeks. And that would mean for that 8-week period of time, they would have to claim each one of those weeks and show us that they were able to work, available for work, and actively seeking work. They would need to show us where they were looking for work, the names of the employers that they were contacting. After that 8 weeks had gone by, then they would serve a waiting week and they would have access to the remaining money in their maximum benefit amount. There would be an 8-week deletion.
Important at this point to explain how many weeks of regular benefits they would qualify for.
Okay, under the example on the top line,
yes,
they would still lose the eight times the weekly benefit amount that they are losing under present law.
So they would have 18 weeks of benefits they could draw before they went to extended benefits.
Right.
Under the top example.
After they signed off, either.
That can't go to extended benefits,
yeah. That's. They would not be able to go to extended benefits unless we changed the law and required that to receive extended benefits, a person had to have worked and earned at least one time their weekly benefit amount. We deleted that from the housekeeping bill 2219 that had passed out of committee.
Could you repeat that? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Unless our law actually stated for extended benefits that a person was required to work and earn money to purge a disqualification, a person who had gone through an 8 or 12 or 16 week sign-off would not be able to draw extended benefits. They would be able to draw the 18 weeks that you indicated, and then at extended benefits, even if they had worked they would not be able to draw unless our law specifically said to draw extended benefits, you must have worked and earned a certain amount of money.
Okay.
Under.
Okay, Representative Johnson, you
If you want to, well, if you want to go further on that example, go ahead.
Okay, Representative Lee.
I'm hearing you say now something that I guess I misapprehended before, and that is that under our current law, you meet a stone wall at the extended benefits without having, whether you've worked again or not.
Representative Leek, under our current law, because our law for regular benefits requires that a person has to work, the only way they can purge it is they have to work and earn some money, then they're okay when they get to extended benefits. If you delete that requirement and say that the person can sign off the weeks of denial, then you would have to put into the extended benefit part of the law that once you hit that wall, then if you worked, the only way you could get your extended benefits is if you worked and earned a certain amount of money.
You know, I guess I assume then in the our discussion before about the composition of the extended benefits dollars on the second page here, you must have taken into assumption the fact that we would make that change in the law and figure taking up these figures.
I believe that is correct.
Yes, we assume that when we showed 12-week and 16-week, that if you were to pass that the bill in that manner, you would also reinstate the section of law that was deleted in the housekeeping bill, because in the housekeeping bill, the assumption was it was no longer needed. If this goes through in any form, an 8-week sign off, a 12, a 16, or whatever, that has to be put back into law to protect those people who do work and would then qualify for extended benefits. But it would only, they would only qualify if it's in our law.
Now,
we did make that
the,
assumption.
Yeah, and we did, yes.
If you could go to the second lower example and explain what happens there. Let's not try to go to whether there's a difference. Just explain what happens under this scenario.
Okay, Representative Johnson, basically what happens under the second scenario is that the people have a longer sign-off period. They have to have signed off 12 weeks or 16 weeks. They also have a commensurate reduction of their total benefit amount of either 12 or 16 weeks. And so they don't have 18 weeks left. They would have under the 12-week reduction 14 weeks left, and under the 16-week reduction 10 weeks left.
I felt that would be useful for the committee so that we had everybody. It's very confusing for everyone, and I felt it would be useful to get that example, those examples, so people can understand. I have nothing further. I think it's useful.
Okay, Representative Lee.
Yeah, one further question. In the first page in the 16-week sign-off category, if you take just in the fiscal year 84, you take the 15 weeks that you're figuring would be average compensated weeks, and you add the current 8-week disqualification in law, you get 23 weeks. You go down to the 16 by 16, basically. If you add 9 to 16, you get 25. There's a similar disparity in the fiscal year 85 figures also. Now, if you're taking into account, you know, the same kinds of things, the same duration, the same likelihood that they're going to go to work, I don't see why there would be that difference.
Representative Leek, we asked the same question when our analyst put together the figures, and he had a basic assumption that the people who actually got through a 16-week sign-off have gone beyond the average duration of those people who normally would have gone to work. If they have gone that far, their likelihood of having found a job is less than the population above, and so they would end up basically drawing out almost all of their benefits. They would have 10 weeks of benefits, and we said that basically there was a 98% survival rate, if you want to look at it that way.
I understand that, and I also have to assume that down in the second example with the 16 by 16, there's going to be a 98% survival rate, that you're going to have the same figures. So indeed, if someone then has a 16-week sign-off, that they've got their 8-week disqualification out there, and the 8 plus the 15 means 23 average weeks that they would have been compensated altogether, okay? Assuming that there were not the 8-week disqualification there. You see what I'm doing? Adding 8 and 15. Now, assuming that the 16 by 16 is in exactly the same category, in other words, there's going to be the same 98% survival rate because they've gone through exactly the same process as the folks up on top, why, when you add 16 to 9, do you get 25 instead of 23? In other words, it's an additional 2 weeks times 3,500 people at a rate of $130 a piece. It's a substantial amount of money. Am I making myself clear?
No.
I don't. If you got a 98% survival rate on the top figure, you know, you can't have 105% survival rate, or 110 or 115% survival rate, which would have to be where you would get to increase your number of compensated weeks from 23 to 25.
Up here, you've got an 18-week potential because you have 8 weeks reduced.
Here you have 16-week final.
All right, and here you have a 10-week potential. So with an 18-week potential, it's 15.
And it's a similar situation with the 12 by 12, okay. Also. Same situation if you add 12 to, if you add 8 to 15, you get 23. If you add 12 to 12, you get 24. 8 to 13 is 21. 12 to 11 is 23.
Ratio of 15 to 18, and the ratio of 9 to 10.
You want me to go call Mike and find out?
I'm not sure, Representative Leake. What I'm looking at is in the 16-week sign-off in the top column, where you've got an 8-week reduction, you have a potential of 18 weeks of benefits. And we're saying that
I'm
once
sorry,
you...
Now, which one, the 16-week?
The top line, 16-week, right-hand side. Okay. You're going to take away 8 weeks.
Okay.
Which leaves a potential of 18 weeks of benefits after you've signed up for 16 weeks.
I understand.
And we're saying that you would probably draw 15 of those 18 weeks.
Right.
In the bottom one, you have a 16-week sign-up. You sign up for 16 weeks. You have only 10 weeks potential benefits, and we're saying you would probably draw 9 of them.
Okay, and what I'm saying is that that is a larger proportion than you're using in the prior example, and that it's right. That if you're using 98% in the top example, you must.
And I'm sure that if our actuary were here, he'd explain it, but he isn't, and I don't know.
Okay. I believe I could say, however, that if you have on the top 18 weeks to get through, that the assumption that he is making is that those people will draw out 15 of those weeks, the average. That's a period of time which some people are finding jobs, some people are dropping off, some people leave the state, whatever. On the bottom, you only have 10 weeks to get through, and we're saying that those people, and they drop off less. I believe the survival rate really is larger on the bottom than it is on the top line. There's 15 whole weeks to get through up there, and we're saying they get through about...
The top one is not then 98% probably.
Probably that is the case. I don't have that figure. I have the figure for the bottom.
Okay, I can see that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any other questions? Any other discussion on the bill? Okay, Representative Leake, what's your pleasure? Do you wish to carry this to another work session?
Yes, I would. Mr. Chairman, counsel has not provided me with the amendments yet on this, and frankly, I would like to get a little bit further along in terms of where, and get a little bit firmer figure on where the fund is going to be before we take some action. I would like to pursue it, though, and I think some action is appropriate.
Okay, I want to remind members that notwithstanding the larger issue raised by the bill, there were distributed earlier amendments prepared by Anita Paulson from the Oregon Legal Services Corporation. Those bear the date April 14, 1983. Members should have that. There's also been distributed, made a part of the record, a letter from the Marion Polk Legal Aid Service dated April 22, 1983. So at Representative Leek's request, we will carry this bill over. If there's further discussion that's necessary, Representative Leek, to get at the assumptions in the fiscal impact statement, I'm sure the Employment Division would be glad to work with you on those. And if you can, if it's necessary to reduce those assumptions in further detail in writing, please let us know. Also, I believe they're going to respond to Representative Johnson's request to an example of a claimant, just how that individual would be affected in each of these categories. And if there is language to be adopted or proposed, let's make sure that Legislative Council has prepared that for our next work session, which I suspect will be the last work session on this bill at this point in the session.
Yeah, I just, if I could ask the Employment Division while they're working up Representative Johnson's request, also let us know how much of the extended benefits, according to your actuary, represents the people who would be affected by 2592, and how much of the extended benefits represents other other claimants.
May I ask a question, Mr. Chairman, on the projections you wanted for the trust fund? I can give you the sheet I was reading from, which gives projections for the end of each quarter for the next 4 or 5 years. If you want to know the actual, and those were developed yesterday, so they're using the latest data. If you want to know the actual for the first quarter of what we collected, I can't give you that probably for 2 weeks, and I'm not, because that's pushing it pretty hard on our collections.
Okay. I, for some reason, the figure May 10th came in my mind is when you post your, or have at least your first posting.
Yeah. Well, I could give you whatever we have as to what we've collected, but for projections of the rest of this year and so forth, I can give you those right now. I can read them into the record if you want.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and make those a part of the record, and we'll distribute that. And I guess when we do come back to our next work session, which may be in 10 to 14 days, why don't you maybe be prepared at that time to give us what your actual first quarter receipts are and how that's affected the fund, and if it's up or down as far as your projection. Representative Lee.
Very small question. Is it possible for you to treat reimbursing employers differently, or employees of reimbursing employers differently from employees of that are in the trust fund?
Treat the employees differently as far as receipt of benefits?
Mm-hmm.
No, that would be out of conformity.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Hunter, you wanted to add something?
I wanted to ask a question. I was not quite clear on if Representative Johnson was asking us to write out an example of what happens to different people under the...
No, I don't. I just wanted an explanation for the committee. Your explanation, I believe, is adequate. I just felt that without that, everybody's swimming in the dark, because it's really difficult to know what happens without using an example. I think it's adequate. Unless other members feel that they need that on paper, I just don't have reason.
Okay, fine. So understood. Thank you, folks. Appreciate it. Okay, the balance of our agenda has to deal with benefits bills that Representative Hanlon and his subcommittee have worked on. I'm really going to basically turn it over to Representative Hanlon and let him present the balance of those bills and the recommendations of the subcommittee for our consideration as he wishes for action or for further discussion. Before we do that, though, I want to, we've got at least one of those bills on the table, and since it appears we're going to be dealing with 2592, at least in another work session, since that's on the table, we might as well take them both off. So the chair would move that House Bill 2592 and House Bill 2700 be removed from the table. Is there any objection to that? If not, they're both removed from the table. Representative Hanlon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Subcommittee on Benefits has met three times now. We have before us the balance of the bills on the agenda. I've asked counsel if she could to, as we go through these, summarize what the recommendations have been to the committee. I might just tell the committee that on House Bills 2376 and 2379, our subcommittee passed those on without recommendation, based on the fact we didn't have the fiscal impact And I received a note from Mr. Gardner from the department this morning indicating that the stuff that we wanted fiscally from the NCCI in New York has not yet arrived and won't arrive until at least noon today, so we still don't have the fiscal implications on the different information we asked for.
Let me interrupt at that point. This is information that we've been asking for at least 2 months. Mr. Green, can you tell us what the problem is?
Mules are still coming.
I think we asked for a different form.
The problem is partially solved.
Okay, well,
I got the information from the National Council and they brought it over to me.
I guess maybe we get spoiled with the Employment Division. We ask for information, and they're generally able to comply within a 1 or 2 week time period.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Roy Green. I'm the director of the Workers' Compensation Department. My computer is not privy to the information of all of the losses, et cetera, that are in the system. As a result, we have to submit information on those things which we are not sure of to the National Council, which is the official rate-making organization for the state of Oregon. We did get some information. I would like to qualify, number one, I don't believe it is correct. Number two, in fact, I am very sure it is not correct. I'm sorry, but I just got them, so I'm afraid that the information which they took over the phone from me was not accurate. At least they did not understand it. I repeated it 2 or 3 times. But I am sure that an increase in the average weekly, or to 200% of the average weekly wage, will be substantially more than 1.7, and I have a hunch it's something like 4 or 5 times that amount. However, number two, 2379, we have checked that out, and we find that that is approximately correct. Number three, they do not have that yet. And that will be several days before they get a final answer to that, because of the fact that they have to apply the federal and the state tax applications to each level of income. Number four, I actually have no estimate of that. I will have to accept that very rough estimate of a 1% decrease, and until I am able to get a hold of the actuary for the National Council, or the chief actuary, Roy Callop, I really can't accept anything except number two. Number two, you can pretty well validate that the total cost of a widow's annuity currently is the total annual cost of a widow's annuity currently is $7,950 per year. A surviving spouse. If that surviving spouse lived 20 years, it would be $159,000. So just on that basis, you can see that with 80 fatalities per year, it is very possible that this 2.1% is accurate.
Let me recognize Representative Shiprock.
Oh, that's okay. I usually would never do that, Mr. Chairman, but seeing as how we're having the ERA today, we have to mention surviving spouse. instead of widow.
Good. 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 Representative Shiprock, we're proud of you.
I corrected myself.
I'm trying to do better.
Are you going to speak on the bill today?
I'm going to, no.
You've done your job.
Let it be recorded that he's done his job.
On the record.
I knew I'd done the right thing when I asked you and Representative Gold to sort of sit in close proximity there.
She's been teaching me a lot. Okay.
I guess,
Mr. Chairperson, I will have the information and the exact information for you just as soon as possible. I have notified the National Council that because of some unique areas of Oregon, that I would ask them to amend or at least change some of their basic statistical methods. Oregon is one of very few states that does not issue an award on the basis of a number of weeks of entitlement for permanent partial disability. As a result, the method of calculation has to be adjusted to take into effect that our awards are by a dollar amount and not by weeks of entitlement. And I am recommending to them that, among other things, they change their method, as far as Oregon is concerned, to include the amounts of money involved in permanent, partial, and a temporary total, rather than in two areas where they call it major permanent partial and minor permanent partial, and include all indemnity payments as part of it. Because when we change temporary total disability, we do not change at the same time the value of permanent partial disability awards, whereas in most states it automatically changes because they are a basis of a number of weeks of entitlement. Every time you change the weekly benefit, the permanent partial disability also is changed. Not so in Oregon. So hopefully in the next few weeks we'll be able to negotiate with them to adjust somewhat from the national approach so that we can get more exact information from them.
These are the same folks that we have relied upon for over these many years to calculate our rates.
Yes. They are a national organization, and they're very responsible. My problem with them is not the responsibility nor the accuracy. It is the response, that is the time in which it takes them to respond to our requests.
They're pretty quick on cents per hour bill as far as the response.
In any event, I'm hoping that we can, they have given us pretty quick answers here. The only problem is that I have yet to receive in writing exactly the basis of all this, and this is why I say, except for the second one, I would hold or reserve my judgment on it.
Mr. Green.
Okay, Representative Hanlon, I'll let you chew on these figures for a while. They don't mean a whole lot to me, just as they're stated.
I agree, and I don't think they're much use this morning, but I do want to ask a question. Mr. Green, on two, sub two, on 2379, which is the widow and widower's bill, this, on your summary sheet, states 66 and two-thirds at time of death, and I want to try and reiterate that our request was,
yes,
for an increase based on the average weekly wage and
right,
not the rate at time of death, and this would indicate to me that this is at the wage at time of death rather than average weekly wage.
Yes.
I just want to make sure that we're communicating on that.
That's right. They have not calculated or finished that yet. This is what is in exactly in the bill.
The original printed
bill.
That's
right, sir. And I have asked them also for the average weekly wage at time of death, which is what the amendment or the suggestion amendment was.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Shiprock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Green, I have to ask, why do we have to go to New York for these? Wouldn't it be more accurate if we used our own experience ratings and all?
We use our own experience ratings. Actually, all they do is utilize a part of their time in doing this. This has been brought up several times since 1971, I believe. The problem is that the cost of their services in relationship to the cost it would take for us to do it is in the relationship of half to a third as much. And unless we want to assume those additional costs in order to get more quick responses to questions, I think we had better stay within the
would be the section affected by Representative Hill's amendment.
Okay. That's where this one stands, and I think I'd ask that we just carry it over until we get the fiscal information necessary to deal with it.
Okay. I'm not sure if Safe Corporation had been as helpful to us on this one as they had on 2376.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Friesen.
I did speak with Mr. Faulkner on a couple of occasions about the fiscal impact of this bill, and he assured me that, in his opinion, the impact on Safe would be negligible, and that was not, in his opinion, important enough to work up a fiscal statement.
Okay, if we can get that in writing so it can be made part of the record, I think that would just kind of lock things in.
Are we talking about 2379 with that statement?
Yes, sir.
I know that Representative Johnson is speaking to the fact that the director of the department had different figures.
I do believe there needs to be further discussion on that issue. I just cannot believe there's no fiscal impact.
Well, I guess our direction to Safe would be, as part of preparing that statement in writing, if there is a negligible impact, that they would, if you will, reconsider that or look anew based upon the statements by Mr. Green and the information this morning. Okay, so the bottom line, Representative Hanlon, you're also recommending that 2379 be carried over for that additional impacts information. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Next.
The next one is the bill originally requested by Representative Katz. We have recommended...
The number. What's the number?
I'm sorry.
2467.
And... you should have in your packets an April 25th, 1983, hand-engrossed version. Oh, you will be getting that at present. The bill, as amended by the subcommittee, basically allows that the mental capacity exception for requesting a hearing on a denied case, it incorporates a mental capacity exception for hearing on a denied case. And if you look at the bill dated April 25th, 1983, basically what that does is it adapts the standards for mental incapacity set by ORS 426 and adopts the rules and regulations under the Mental Health Division thereunder. We had some discussion at the subcommittee concerning this, and it was recommended that this be passed out with a due pass recommendation from the subcommittee. And basically, we've adopted Representative Gold's suggested amendments with an addition that we also include the rules of the Mental Health Division under ORS 426 in defining the standard as to who would qualify for this exception. So the recommendation to the main committee was to adopt House Bill 2467 as amended April 25th, 1983, and that recommendation came to your committee on a 2-1 vote. And that would be my recommendation. Also, I might just say that there was commentary as to whether or not this would cause additional litigation, and I think that Representative Johnson's vote was based on the fact he thought it would, and my vote was based on the fact that we did not think this would engender additional litigation, and it was the tightest standard that we knew how to put in the statute for the exception.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
I believe that my concern is fairly close to what Representative Hannon has described. I had asked that someone from SAFE give us their view, someone from the legal staff give us their view of how wide did we open the door. That was the concern, that because we're really dealing with one case, specifically the Nelson versus SAFE case, and one person where this has occurred. And I feel comfortable in opening the door a little ways beyond saying that the person has to have been institutionalized before to qualify for this exemption or this change in the statutes. But I'm not prepared to support anything until I know how far we've opened the door, and that's really my concern. I mean, no vote is not that I was not based on my lack of concern about the issue of the person who would be mentally incapacitated, but really a lack of understanding about what we really did. And if someone from SAFE, if we do have someone from SAFE here who could address that issue, could you come up and tell the committee what you believe to be what you believe we have done with this amendment?
Let's hear. Let me ask Mr. Lyons to take a seat, and then we'll. I want to take a question or comment first from Representative Ford, and then Representative Gold, and then maybe we'll understand the context of the response. Representative Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if I understood what Representative Johnson's concerns were, but I have a similar one with the new language that would say, or voluntary admission. And not that I have a suspicious mind on people, but in working with the mental health institutions, when I said to damage an admission voluntarily, they could be out the next day and there would be no treatment necessary. And I wondered if you meant to say voluntary admission and treatment.
Mr. Chair, I think in responding to that, it was my understanding that under ORS 426, the standards for voluntary or involuntary admission are the same to the facility under the definitions of that statute.
Yeah, I have to take those out and read them because I'm still not clear on that.
Well, Representative Hanlon, would it do any great violence to your intent to include those two additional words, voluntary admission and treatment?
Perhaps we could hear what.
Oh, I have something I would like to
say. Yeah. Why don't we think about that for just a moment, okay. Representative Hanlon, and let me recognize Representative Gold.
I have a further suggestion that I think will clarify one of the words that we're using in there. We've been using the word capacity throughout, as you will notice in the amendment, and in discussion with a few different people.
I think the word competency is a better word, because capacity, and thinking back to my teaching days, English teacher days, capacity kind of speaks to intelligence quotient, in a sense, where competency is, speaks to a person's condition in a given slot of time, and within parameters of a given slot of time. So at the point at which you would be ready for any kind of motions, Mr. Chair, I'll be suggesting the substitution of the word competency wherever we see capacity. I don't know if how Representative Hanlon feels about that.
If I might ask a question on that, of our counsel, because I think she was instrumental so far as preparing these. The question I have for everybody's benefit is, would the addition of "and treatment" and the replacement of capacity with competency do any violence to ORS 426? Because we're trying to go by an established standard. We're not. We're trying not to get away from it. So that's my question of Ms. Friesen.
Certainly, I don't believe the substitution of competency for capacity would do any violence to your intent, Representative Hanlon. It's a narrowing kind of language, speaks to ability rather than mental state in general. And I second what Representative Gold has said about the effect of that word. Voluntary admission and treatment is required. Again, on reviewing the rules, I've just gone through the Mental Health Division rules for the criteria for admission and treatment. I don't think that would do any violence to your intent either. The admission criteria that the Mental Health Division uses for involuntary commitment and voluntary admission is the same. And a person who seeks voluntary admission or who is sought to be involuntarily committed must be suffering from a severe mental disorder. The severe mental disorder is defined in the rules which I've distributed as a psychotic disorder or other mental disorder of comparable severity. Psychotic is again further defined to mean a gross impairment of reality testing, incoherence. This is on, I'm reading from page 3 of the packet that I've given you. People who suffer from such a disorder, their thinking, according to the rules, is so disordered they have substantially lost touch with reality.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Ford.
Then what I think you're saying is that the interpretation in the statute of admission is acceptance by the institution, not just the act of going there and requesting that they be placed.
I think that's a correct interpretation. I think
I would like that to be listed as intent,
certainly,
and that would solve my problem.
Certainly.
Admission being acceptance by the facility.
Okay. I think our interpretation of admission would be the same as the definitions under the rule 309-31-205, which means, as used in these rules, admission means accepting a person for treatment.
That does answer.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment in hearing Ms. Friesen's outline of some of the criteria, it seems that our admission to this facility on January 10th and our subsequent disorientation might fall into a lot of the categories that she described, the loss of reality and just a lot of people.
But is it compensable?
Okay, so we're admission will stand with the understanding of the intent as stated in these rules.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
couple more words on in relation to substituting competency for capacity. I think that substitution should assist somewhat in Representative Johnson's concerns, because it
I think the word will further limit the parameters of what we're discussing.
This does raise some caution, Mr. Chair, in that further, as you read this, a temporary admission could be granted because of the fact that they didn't have a somebody present to screen them. It also could be admitted because a private physician has referred with no legal mandate that they are ill. I don't know whether we made it worse or better right now when we start dealing with this further. I don't wonder. I'd really like to hear what this fellow believes we have as a starting base, and then look at the minimums.
Well, I guess my only response, and I appreciate the careful concern we're giving to the subject, I can't imagine, in my limited experience, that we're going to have a plethora of people that are going to be affected or screaming into mental institutions seeking voluntary admission for whatever reason because they've missed a deadline. Lord knows I could be wrong, but I just I just don't quite see it happening, but I'll be glad to hear from Mr. Lyons, particularly if he has an interpretation of contrary to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Alan Lyons, speaking on behalf of SAFE Corporation. The SAFE has already testified with regard to this particular House bill and had proposed an amendment that would have narrowed it to actual commitment. And I would point out to the committee that, as has already been mentioned among the committee members, this particular bill was drafted and introduced to address one case, and that was the case of Cigna Nelson versus SAFE Corporation. In the approximately 70 years of Oregon's workers' compensation law, there has been only one case that has dealt with this particular problem as far as we have been able to determine. I don't think that it is a significant problem such that the entire section of the comp law has to be amended to try to protect cases of this type in the future. But if the committee feels that it is significant enough, that it should limit itself to the exact factual situation that was addressed by the court in the Cigna Nelson case. We don't have any statistics as to how many people this might affect, simply because there's only been the one case. There have been, to the best of my knowledge and experience over the past 10 years of my involvement with the compensation practice, no instances where a claimant has come in and said, I missed my 60-day deadline because I was mentally incapacitated or I could have been voluntarily admitted. I would further point out, as we have testified in the past, that the attorney for Cigna Nelson conferred at great length with Barbara Brainerd, who was formerly of our staff and who did testify and propose the amendment, and that she was in agreement with our proposal that actual commitment would be sufficient for her purposes and for protection of situations such as were addressed. Another thing that I would like to point out is the fact that with all other claimants, they are limited to 60 days after the denial. This amendment would extend that to 1 year after the claimant regains mental competency, if there has been some sort of a mental incompetency in existence. It seems to us that if all other claimants are limited to 60 days, that once someone is again declared to be mentally competent, that 60-day time period should begin to toll rather than giving them some added benefit by extending it to 1 year. The fear that we have is that the language that says as is required for commitment or voluntary admission will in fact result in additional litigation because you have a question of fact introduced. There is no finding that the person has these limitations that would allow commitment or voluntary admission. And the fear that we have is that that issue will be litigated in every case that the claimant misses the 60-day or the 180-day deadline, that that will raise the specter of was the claimant mentally competent or not, and let's go to the psychiatrist or to the psychologist and find out. And so you begin getting additional medical testimony or psychological testimony to try to determine where was this individual mentally at the time the denial letter was received. If you limit it to actual commitment, or at the risk of somewhat opening the door, if you limit it to an actual voluntary admission at the time that the denial was received, not subsequently, but at the time, at least you have an identifiable time frame and an identifiable factual situation. Either the worker was or was not in a mental institution of some type or other. That could be used to create the presumption of lack of ability to file within the 60-day time frame. But we're very concerned that this language that says as is required for the commitment or voluntary admission raises a whole new factual issue that would have to be litigated.
Okay, Ms. Lyons, in response, up till 1975, as you may know, the law did provide that, quote, if the workman was rendered mentally incapable of seeking compensation, and there's a causation factor, because of the accidental injury, 6 months after the removal of such mental incapacity, if parents, guardians, employer, physician, or other person have not requested a hearing on his behalf within 1 year after the accident. In other words, there was an opportunity prior to 1975 for this kind of extension of the period. Can you advise me how great was the litigation on the issue of mental incapability prior to 1975?
Well, as I've indicated, to the best of my knowledge, it was not litigated.
Okay.
It was not litigated. What I'm concerned about is that the language that's used in the proposed amendment is different. Maybe not significantly, but I think substantially enough different from the original language pre-75.
Okay, well, I'm suggesting, I guess, that this language, to the extent that it's going to be a subject of litigation, the language that existed before 1975, i.e., rendered mentally incapable of seeking compensation because of the accidental injury, was just as likely to be litigated, and the fact that apparently it was not the subject, at least of litigation, as reflected in the appellate records, leads me to conclude, personally, that although your concern is a valid one, it's not significant enough based upon the history, as I understand it, to, unless we have some language that, other than actual commitment, that can be suggested, that it's, again, your concern, although valid, does not rise to the level of requiring a change. Representative Leake.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, leaving aside the historical perspective, which I think is a valid one, the reference in the proposed amendments to the rules and the other statute, which outlines specifically that the lack of mental capacity or mental competency has to involve danger to oneself or another, or being unable to provide basic personal needs, it strikes me that that's a rather strong test and not really open to a whole lot of litigation. That just every Tom, Dick, and Jane that's who is late with his filing is not going to threaten people on the street with a weapon or soil his pants in order to prove that he or she was not able to file in the appropriate time frame. It seems to me that it's a fairly clear, I don't know if you've seen 426.005, it seems that it's pretty clear in a rather extreme circumstance, not the broad suggestion that you might, you know, that you lead us to believe.
Representative Leek, that's true. The concern is that when we're looking in the workers' compensation framework, you're looking at a situation of going into hearing a year or more from the date of accident, from the date of denial, and so on, based upon how long the motions and the continuances and all take. Because you have those identifiable standards, perhaps, you're going to be opening the door, because that gives you the factual context in which to bring the litigation of the sides bringing in their respective witnesses. Looking in retrospect to the date of the denial, do you, doctor, feel that this claimant met those qualifications?
That he was dangerous to himself or others.
That's
that he
right.
was unable to provide for his personal needs.
That's right. And you've got speculation, because you may have, since it does not require an actual commitment or voluntary admission, you've got speculation from someone who's being brought in after the fact, and in many instances considerably after the fact, trying to go back and recreate the individual's state of mind.
And you believe that a large number of claimants who are late with their filings are going to base their appeal on these kinds of grounds.
I believe it could be. In the past, the bell hadn't been rung, if you will. With the Cigna Nelson case, it has. I think that's going to make more people aware, just the existence of that case, more people being aware of it. You run the risk then of additional litigation based on that. When something finally gets into the appellate reporters, it creates concern. It brings attention to itself.
I guess my last question is, are you aware of the institutionalization trend in our society?
Yes, I am.
And do you not believe the statute should reflect?
That's that? One more than the last
Sorry.
Question.
I'll pick it up, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Okay, let's
be
not,
glad to pick it up.
Okay. Representative Golden, let's try to be conscious that we got three bills waiting and people waiting all morning.
Okay, two items. One is to pick up on Representative Leek's question. The problem we're dealing with in this bill is exactly what he began to bring up in asking you the question, which is this continues to be a certain amount of institutionalization, which is easy for us to deal with. But as a number of us know who work on the Human Resources Committee, for example, there is a trend toward deinstitutionalization, community outpatient type care. Those people are as deeply in need as are others. And for us to blatantly commit ourselves to a piece of legislation that would ignore that would be derelict for us as legislators to consider, and for you as a state official to countenance. The second part of my statement is that I am rapidly losing patience with the thought on the part of some of our witnesses, and I apologize that you are the one who happens to be there, that there are these crowds of people waiting out there to declare themselves mentally incapable in order to benefit by this, that there are these crowds of people out there who choose to live in sin so that they can collect whatever it is, that there are those who will marry the incapacitated in order to collect whatever there is, and I have no patience whatsoever to continue in this vein in terms of impugning the character of the populace out there. So can we please move the agenda?
Thank you. Representative Gold moves that where the word capacity appears, that the word competency be substituted therefore.
I have one question.
Yes, Representative DeBoer.
I know this is Representative Katz's bill. Has anyone discussed, has she seen the amendments and everything?
We have discussed the amendments with Noreen Saltbite, who is the attorney who is the who appeared with Representative Katz, and it's our understanding that Ms. Saltbite in that capacity is aware of and has no objection to the action that we're taking.
That's all I'm...
The chief sponsor, of course, is, in case anyone's forgotten, the co-chair of Ways and Means, and I think the fact that she's brought the issue to us indicates that she has an abiding interest in some action being taken.
Right.
And we certainly respect that.
Shirley, you talked about changing that with her then, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay.
Is there any further discussion on Representative Gold's motion? Change capacity to competency. That's adopted. Okay.
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Hanlon, you move the amendments as amended.
I do.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the motion to
move
the amendments as amended? Is there any objection?
One more question. Did
yes,
you then go ahead with the, where you went into, did you change or to an and? I know there was some discussion on that where on lot, well, it's not, it's in the bottom section. Something when we were dealing with the voluntary admission. It was something Representative Ford was talking about.
I think her concern was that we state voluntary admission and treatment to a treatment facility, but I believe our later discussion as to the definition and the rule that would apply for admission took care of that concern.
Oh, I just couldn't remember whether she made a motion or not.
No, she, I recall, I'm sorry.
Yes, Representative Gold.
To confirm Mr. Chair's comment, my understanding was that Representative Ford felt that that was taken care of by the statement of intent that was described.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Have we adopted that?
No, we have not. Is there any further discussion on the motion to adopt the amendments as amended? Is there any objection?
Mr.
Adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
I move House Bill 2467 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair.
As amended.
Let me place the motion. Representative Hanlon moves House Bill 2467 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. And it is understood that our amendments here will be reviewed by Legislative Council to ensure that form and style and any problems there are adequately addressed. Representative Johnson.
I'm not comfortable with what we have before us. It's not a compelling, overwhelming issue as I see it, but I do believe that we'll find ourselves back dealing with this issue in subsequent sections, subsequent sessions as a result. I come to conclude after hearing the testimony that what we really should be doing is adopting the SAFE amendments, because I don't happen to concur that deinstitutionalization issue has anything to do with the issue whether you're in this bill or whether you're mentally competent. What we've dealt with here is a set of standards that deal with admission or commitment